on 88.1 It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. My guest today is Scott Shane. He's a former reporter for the Baltimore Sun who has covered national security for the New York Times since 2004. His latest book is about how a Muslim cleric named Anwar al-Awlaki evolved from a moderate imam who denounced the 9/11 attacks into one of the most celebrated and influential figures in the cause of violent jihad. In 2009, he helped plan an unsuccessful attack on a plane headed for Detroit. He was influential to the perpetrators of attacks at Fort Hood in Texas and at the Boston Marathon. By 2010, the U.S. government considered only Osama bin Laden to be more powerful and influential than al-Awlaki as a fomenter of violence against Americans. The effort to locate and kill him was dubbed Objective Troy. Scott Shane's fascinating and assiduously reported book tells the story of that operation and elucidates the complexities and geopolitical ramifications of that mission to American foreign policy in the Middle East and to the essential moral fundaments of our democracy. It is a great read. It's called Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone. Scott Shane will be speaking about the book tonight at the Pratt Library. Today he joins me in the studio. It's good to see you.
Great to see you, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
So, spoiler alert here for everybody. Anwar al-Awlaki dies in a drone strike in September of 2011. Drones had been used before that mission. They are used to this day. There's tons of video evidence that shows al-Awlaki encouraging Muslims to kill Americans. He collaborated with the so-called underwear bomber on Christmas Day who tried to blow up a plane, Umar Abdulmutallab. But among constitutional scholars, it's simply not a cut-and-dry case that this guy should have been killed. He seems like a terribly bad guy. Why is it so complicated?
I guess it's partly because the Constitution guarantees that you're not going to be deprived of life or liberty or without due process of law. And the Obama administration decided that due process in this case was essentially a bunch of folks inside the executive branch going over secret intelligence that they believed proved that Anwar al-Awlaki was a threat to the United States, and that was adequate. Some scholars accept that view.
Other scholars. And of course, we should mention that what perhaps distinguishes al-Awlaki from some of these other folks is that al-Awlaki was an American citizen.
An American citizen. Yeah. So that we're talking about U.S. Constitutional rights. Others believe that, you know, due process really means judicial due process. It means, you get to face your accusers in a court of law. You get to be judged. Your innocence and guilt gets to be judged by a jury of your peers and so on. That is certainly the traditional concept of what's necessary before the government orders the execution of an American citizen. So that remains highly controversial.
And he was the first American citizen to be killed in such a manner.
Right? Yeah, actually, he was not the first American citizen to be killed, but the first one to be deliberately killed.
Yeah,
what happened in a couple of cases before that was there were Americans. There have always been a handful of American citizens who've been part of al-Qaeda in Pakistan or in Yemen. And so in some cases, they took a shot at a bunch of people they believed to be associated with al-Qaeda, and one of them turned out to be an American.
Let's give a little background to Mr. al-Awlaki. He's born in the United States. His parents were in the U.S. They're from Yemen. His parents were studying. His father was studying at university. He's born there and then lives here until he's seven, moves back to Yemen until he's 19. Pick it up from when he goes to college in Colorado at the age of 19.
So his father, Nasser al-Awlaki, had actually, after his American education, become a very prominent guy in Yemen. He was agriculture minister, chancellor of a university. So he sends his oldest son, Anwar, back to the States for an engineering education with the idea that he'll kind of become a technocrat and move back to Yemen, help out this impoverished country. And what happens is somewhat different from what his father plans. Fascinating story from Anwar's freshman year at Colorado State. His roommate at the time, a Saudi guy named Ghassan Khan, told me about how he went home to Saudi Arabia for the holidays, but Anwar stayed on campus in Colorado State. You know, you can kind of picture that. Winter in Colorado, a little bit bleak, a little bit abandoned campus. Anyway, he fell under the influence of some older sort of puritanical graduate students. And by the time his roommate got back, Anwar had been sort of, converted into this puritanical scold. For first semester, he'd been drinking and chasing girls and having a good time. And now all of a sudden, he was against all kinds of things, including TV. And his roommate told me about how he actually picked up the TV and smashed it on the ground. He also, though, on a sort of more serious note, I think he moderated some of that sort of callow puritanism of his initial exposure to this sort of brand of Islam. But he subsequently discovered a real knack for preaching in college, because at Colorado State, I went out to the campus, and for many years there's been a mosque sort of in a house at the edge of campus. They don't have a professional imam, so professors and students take turns giving Friday prayers, leading Friday prayers. And Anwar found that he was very good at this and began to began getting sort of more interest in the history of Islam, the history of religion.
Scott Shane's latest book is called Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. So he abandons engineering, goes into being a full-time imam. He has a mosque in San Diego. He ends up in Washington at one of the largest mosques in the United States. The 9/11 attacks occur, and he is elevated in the media as the voice of moderation. He wrote personal emails to his brother that you have in the book that says, you know, this is a terrible idea, this is a bad thing. By the time of this, early 2000s, he's already achieved a fair amount of notoriety. He leaves the United States about 11 years later, but it has nothing to do with terrorism. He leaves for completely different reasons that were really kind of shocking when you heard about it.
Yes. It's not 11 years later. It's he leaves some months after 9/11, about 6 months.
Oh, I'm sorry.
After
9/11. Yeah.
And so about
2002, yes.
Yeah, okay. March of 2002. Mm-hmm. So in March of 2002, there were some very heavy-handed federal raids on Islamic institutions in Northern Virginia. And they were kind of mainstream institutions. It was supposedly a terrorist financing investigation, but nothing much came of it. And it angered a lot of people in that community because they felt they were, loyal Americans and shouldn't be treated this way. And Anwar Awlaki, as the imam at this big mosque in Falls Church, Virginia, right outside D.C., gave a sermon, which you can still find like just about everything he ever said on YouTube, in which he was quite clearly furious and sort of channeling the anger of the community there about these raids. A few days after giving that sermon, Anwar Awlaki boards a plane for the U.K. and only comes back one more time to the United States in his life. And it's been sort of assumed that he left because he just couldn't stand that kind of wave of hostility to Muslims in the wake of 9/11. But once again, his younger brother sort of made it clear to me that that was not the case, because it happened to be that his brother was visiting him at that time. And he'd asked Anwar, when are you coming back to Yemen? Because he kind of wanted him to come back and help the country. He looked up to his brother. And Anwar said, you know what, things are going great here. I have no intention of leaving. I plan to spend my career here, spend my life here. Then a few days later, he disappears. It turns out that what had happened in the interim is the manager of an escort service that Anwar Awlaki had been using to set up dates with prostitutes called him and said the FBI had visited, and it was quite clear that the FBI had a big file on Anwar Awlaki's visits to prostitutes. What had happened was the FBI was a bit worried about Awlaki because he had had two of the hijackers, the 9/11 hijackers, in his mosque in San Diego. And they wanted to check out, what did this mean? Was there any connection between Awlaki and the plot? So they started following him around after 9/11. They could find no evidence whatsoever that he was a terrorist or that he had links to Al-Qaeda. But they did discover that he was regularly visiting prostitutes. He was a preacher before a very conservative congregation. He had, denounced the kind of, you know, sex in the media on TV and movies and so on, and given sermons about marriage and, you know, the sanctity of marriage. So this was a kind of horrible thing for him to discover, that the FBI could expose him at any time, ruin his career, ruin his family life. And that was, it turns out, what sent him on the road.
Yeah, so he's Jim and Tammy Faye Baker all in one.
It's, very familiar story, but in the sort of Islamic context.
You talk a lot about President Obama's evolution on drone use, the difference between how he campaigned for the presidency in 2007 and 2008, and then once he became president. You write that Obama himself and his team had actually become radicalized by the threat of violence, from what a lot of people call radical Islam, although the president refuses to use that terminology. So just as Anwar al-Awlaki had gotten essentially radicalized at some point in his life, the president was radicalized, in your view, in terms of his willingness to use drone strikes.
Yeah, I think a lot of people were surprised at Obama's embrace of the drone of targeted killing. And that was sort of natural because he had campaigned against what he saw as the excesses of the Bush counterterrorism programs, in particular, torture, secret prisons overseas, the prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And so there was sort of an assumption that he'd take a different approach. Bush had escalated drone strikes in Pakistan in the last 6 months of his presidency. And, that was somewhat controversial at the time. And there was a sort of assumption, I think, among liberals that Obama might scale that back. Instead, he went the other direction. And what I found was that if you look carefully at what Obama was saying, and he was quite constrained as a senator running for president because the drone program was technically classified, and so he would never use the word drone. He'd never talk explicitly about it. But what it turned out that what he was really against was the big wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, which he felt had killed a lot of civilians, generated a lot of hostility to the United States, and in terms of American security against terrorism, had very equivocal results. No one could really say that invading Afghanistan, let alone invading Iraq, had really made the U.S. safer from terrorism. So Obama was actually very attracted to the drone as a technology, as a weapon. He often told aides, let's kill the people who are trying to kill us, by which he meant, the war in Iraq had cost hundreds of thousands of civilian lives by some counts. And the drone was this pinpoint weapon that could knock out two or three or five terrorists without killing a large number of civilians. So in a way, for a president who kind of wanted to focus on the domestic issues, healthcare and so on, and who was trying to pull out of the big wars, the drone seemed like the right tool to deal with the terrorist threat.
Well, there is so much to think about in this very provocative book. Unfortunately, we're out of time to think about it right now, but particularly the notion that people like Awlaki might actually be more detrimental and more dangerous to the United States in death than they were in life. Thank you so much. Good to see you.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks very much for having me.
Scott Shane, his new book is called Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone. Scott will be discussing the book tonight at the Enoch Pratt Library. It's part of the library's Writers Live series. You can meet him in the Poe Room at the Pratt tonight at 6:30. We've got information about the book as well as a link to the conversation that Scott had with Dan Rodericks on Midday a couple of weeks ago. That's all on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning.